With the magnificence of eternity before us, let time, with all its fluctuations, dwindle into its own littleness. Thomas Chalmers. Welcome to Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I am your host. Welcome. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. I appreciate your support. I want to go ahead and apologize to start. You may hear some audio in the background. My air conditioning has been completely shot this weekend, and I am dying. My apartment has hovered between like 80 and 88 degrees all weekend, and I have to have a fan on, otherwise I will pass out. So apologies. But I do want to go ahead and thank everyone for all the support. Again, it really means a lot to me, and I'm glad that people seem to have enjoyed the last episode, and I hope you'll enjoy this one. And this week, we're going to talk about the peoples inhabiting the region we went over last episode, what we know, what we don't know, and how our knowledge and theories have changed over time. To that end, I want you to think about what you know about the earliest civilizations, and where are they? Now, if you're using this show to learn about history, you may not know that much, or at least not that much more than what you learned in school. Now, you also might enjoy history as a hobby and have picked up more than the standard amount of information than most people who only learn about the subject in school know. You may have specialized in history and know more about it than most, or even me, and that's very probable in some cases. Regardless of your level of knowledge, you could probably name at least one of these early civilizations. Egypt, the Indus Valley Civilization, Mesopotamia, Sumeria, Chinese civilization, etc. Well, what if I told you that there was another civilization that emerged in the twilight before the dawn of written records emerged, and then split into a number of city-states and kingdoms that lived in and controlled the northern Levant from the coast to the northern Euphrates River Valley, a civilization dubbed as Kish. This theory was proposed by a Polish-American scientist by the name of Ignaz J. Gelb. Gelb was a very prominent Assyriologist during the kind of the 20s to the 50s, and even after that, but that was kind of his high point. He was particularly famous for his study of early writing systems and using a harder, and I use that with quotes, like hard science. He used hard scientific standards for examining languages, a little bit more in depth than what most would consider classical linguistics. Excuse me. Now, he believed that the region we are discussing was the original homeland of the Eastern Semitic speaking peoples, who would go on to found the major cities of the area and in the portion of Mesopotamia that would eventually be known as Akkad. This would include Kish, is kind of in this region as well, hence the name. However, his theory was also wrong, very wrong in some respects. Not to throw too much shade on Dr. Gelb, he was a very important scientist. Some of his theories, as I said, have been discredited, specifically his work on the Mayan hieroglyphs, or at least what he thought about the Mayan hieroglyphs. But that's not to say that his work is without value or without, you know, a lot of good information that he turned up. He was very responsible for deciphering a lot of hieroglyphics. However, his theories on the progression of writing systems was a little too rigid and has kind of been discredited, but he is still very important, very influential. And we're going to talk about his theory more later, but you may find some older sources talk about this, but just keep in mind that, you know, especially within the last 10 to 15 years, it's really, a lot of people have completely disregarded it altogether. So instead of a single people living in this area, you actually have a number of peoples who will eventually be mentioned by Sumerian and Akkadian sources and other sources later. In addition to migrants from the Sumerian and the Akkadians, who, you know, they'll migrate into the area as well. So you have the people who are living there, the people who Sumerian and Akkadian sources mention, who are from a later period. And, of course, you have the migrants from Sumeria and Akkadia who move in. Now, I mentioned last episode that coastal settlements in this time, in this region, tended to be smaller than the towns and proto-cities in the central and southern Levant. And that's true. But just as today, there were some. One early sightseeing habitation this season along the northern coast was at a place called Ugarit. Now, I couldn't get a firm meaning of the name, but there are a couple of explanations. The most common that you'll see is that it just means arable land. That's what the name, when you transliterate it into Akkadian and Sumerian, means. It could also mean like white stone or white place, something along those lines. This site will eventually become a fairly prominent city, but that doesn't happen until the Bronze Age. You see a semi-permanent settlement emerge around 7000 BC, but it doesn't really become a fully permanent settlement until around 6000, so right at the start of this season. This is a pre-pottery site. In fact, its pottery isn't found at the site until right around 4000 BC. Now, the fact they don't have pottery, while their neighbors do, tends to suggest that this might be a site established by locals, possibly by one of the several peoples living in the nearby mountains or hills to their east. By the end of this season, though, there is clear evidence of long-range trade. You find artifacts associated with peoples to the north, south, and east all showing up the site, though it's in very small numbers. And again, the site does not become truly like city, well, you wouldn't consider it like a very impressive city until much later. And even then, it was never a city of the first rank. It's always kind of on the peripheral, but it does use its position fairly well. But it's never, I don't even know if we could say it's truly independent. It's always kind of vying with overlords or very large rivals that they're having to kind of buy protection off of or play off against one another. But again, that's all stuff for the future. Now, again, who built this first site isn't known. We're not sure at all. The site will be abandoned for about 100 years between 1650 and 1550 BC. And it will be reoccupied by people speaking a descendant tongue of Western Semitic. We'll go into the exact branch and family later when we talk about Ugarit. The artifacts found at this time frame, this season, don't match what we see in other areas associated with the expansion of the Proto-Semitic peoples. These people don't begin to establish settlements in the northern Levant until around 500 years or so after this season ends. And they do so on the other side of the coastal Syrian mountains first. These will be places that we're going to talk about in a lot of detail next season. This includes Ebla, Mari, and a couple of others that I am drawing a blank on. Forgive me. Again, it is very hot right now. Now, these people are arriving in the area around the end of this season. I think at least by 4200, you probably see some Western Semitic descendants coming up through the Orontes River Valley and entering into that Gelb Depression that we talked about last week. But they aren't establishing cities this season, that or even large-scale communities. They're still fairly mobile, pastoralists. In fact, there's probably a lot of peoples in this region all during this season who are either nomadic pastoralists or hunter-gatherers. But again, with the way the food situation is and, of course, climate, the hunter-gatherer population is only going to get smaller going forward. or maybe smaller is not the right term. It's not going to grow at the same pace as the permanent settlements or the pastoralists' population is growing. But the Semitic peoples who are arriving, they are either going to end up mixing with or displacing these pre-existing populations. And these are, at least the Semitic peoples are bringing the proto-version of their language or their branch of Western Semitic, which will eventually become known as Amurun, or as it's known in the Bible, Amorites. Amurun is what the Sumerians and the Akkadians, who are an Eastern Semitic-speaking peoples, what they will refer to the Amorites are. And the Amorites are the ones who will found a number of city-states in this side of the coastal Syrian mountains, or I should say the eastern side of the coastal Syrian mountains. Now, further to the northwest, in Anatolia, in the region of Cilicia, that we discussed last time, we have a number of permanent settlements emerging as well. And these have been, probably have been at least towns or villages before this season. But the one that will become the best known and the one that's probably the longest established is, or will become known as Adana. Now, who founded this site is heavily debated, as is the origin of the name. The first recorded peoples to live in the region are known as Luwians. They're first mentioned in records dating to around 2000 BC, and their language is considered either Indo-European or a descendant of a language that is a sister tongue of Indo-European. And they're not believed to arrive in this region until around 3000 BC or so. And if that is true, it is more likely than not that they did not originally found Adana, because Adana has been around since at least 6000 BC as a permanent city or town or village or whatever you want to call it. Though they could have renamed it, that's certainly possible to Adana. And if that is the case, then it's possible Adana may be a corruption of Adanu, which means on the river in Indo-European. Now, there are several place and river names that share this root, the Danube, the Dnieper, just to name two of them. Another theory holds that Adana was founded by a people speaking a language related to Hurrian and or Urartian. Now, these are two languages that are they're in the same branch of a family, and the most recent research I've read seems to believe that they are related to the Caucasian languages or the Kartvelian languages. Or it's possible that they're from what is now modern Iran or Armenia, somewhere in that region. Regardless of the origin, metalworking and pottery developed here very early. In fact, I think Adana has pottery dating back to its foundation, so the people moving in there already had pottery, and they enter the Copper Age around the same time as places in Mesopotamia, toward the end of this season, which, or well, I guess the middle to end of this season. It's kind of back and forth on that in terms of time frame, which seems to indicate that either they developed metallurgy independently, or migrants from places that were already practicing metallurgy moved in and shared knowledge with peoples who had already established Adana and other nearby towns and settlements. Which, to me, would indicate, you know, that's a point for me in the Caucasian / Northern Persia column. Now, the Hurrians and the Urartians, they will continue to exist, and they'll form their own kingdoms and regions, and they'll be mentioned in Mesopotamian sources and Hittite sources, who are peoples that will move in later as well. But this area because of the geography, you do have a lot of, you know, smaller, semi-isolated communities where a number of different peoples can establish niches for themselves politically, economically, socially, all that kind of stuff. And this is something that I think is happening even this season, though, again, we're not sure if the Hurrians or Arartrians are part of this, or if it's their distant cousins, or if they're just completely unrelated people. It's impossible to say. I don't think any DNA tests have proven things one way or the other, though there are also probably people related to earlier settlements or attempts of permanent settlements in the region, such as the Tostepler or Chatelhoyuk sites. This is something that is probably partly homegrown and partly imported into the region from other nearby sources. And this would include places in the northern Levant. And you'll see a lot of mixing of religious customs and names. And there's some definite back and forth between all of these places when it comes to things like that. In fact, there is thought that the god of the Canaanite religion, Baal, there are some theories that hold that the Canaanites believe that Baal was originally from the mountains around Adana that we talked about last week. So it's possible that they associated Baal's birth or homeland with a place not entirely where they are from. That Baal found them after leaving this place. And that could have been a reason that they moved in. Or it could have been a justification after the fact of why they were moving closer. But the Canaanite, Levantine religions are definitely tied into the Anatolian and Mesopotamian religions. And they're tied in more closely in these regions than they are in Canaan and in Mesopotamia I'm going to try to phrase that a little bit better. There is more mixing of the religion in the northern Levant and southern Anatolia than there is in the central or southern Levant or in Mesopotamia, though, again, there is a little bit of back and forth the other way, though not nearly as much. Another site that you can kind of see very clear evidence of mobility between southern Anatolia, the northern Levant, is known as the Amik Valley. This is right around the modern-day Syria-Turkish border. There used to be a lake here called Lake Amik. It was actually drained fairly recently. I think in the 50s and 60s, it was drained out to make arable land. This will become the site of another Amorite village known as Alala. Alalak. Forgive me. It was inhabited as early as 6000 BC. There were some smaller villages and things like that. The city was not founded until a little bit later, I think around 2000 BC, give or take. There are a number of smaller tales all throughout this valley. This valley is one of the places that is believed to be the site of Armageddon. In the Islamic tradition, this is one of the places that Armageddon I've tried to figure out my words here. Some in Islam believe that this will be the site of the Battle of Armageddon at the end of days. And I'm not sure about Jewish or Christian theology. I don't know if this is one of their potential Armageddon sites. But it's actually a very beautiful place. I've seen some pictures. Long green fields broken up by some hills and probably tells that are hiding other small villages. But it's about 2 miles or a mile and a half from the modern Syria-Turkish border. I don't think those two are going to cause the end of the world, but who knows. Another site in the Amak Valley, is Çatal Höyük. Now, that is not to be confused with the famous Çatal Höyük. This is two words, spelled slightly differently, but it is also found in the Amak Valley. And it is located, I guess, where the Orontes River flows through. And it was inhabited from around 4000 BC on, so it's another small settlement. It is also one that will eventually become a fairly large town. It's like one of the big bases for the Hittite Empire in the region. It helps them control that section of the river and the coastal, or not the coastal plain, but the plain of Amak. It's one of their big sites. I think the growth of that town is actually one of the reasons that Alalak starts to lose some of its prominence. Though I would have to double check on that one. But from the dates, it seems likely. Now, again, I'm not aware of any DNA from this season in the region, sadly. At least nothing that would be out of the ordinary. Now, I know that there is some DNA that's found from around 2000 BC in this site, but it basically shows a continuance of population between this area and people living in Ebla. So, what you would expect. They're very, very closely related to the Ammonite population. Excuse me, the Amorite population. Though, again, how long of a trend this is, we don't know. But there is very clear geographic divisions between the sites. They had very firm borders. Well, I wouldn't say firm. They're permeable, and you could get through them, but there seems to be some type of control preventing large-scale migrations between the two. Or at least there were at that later period. But there was definitely a continuity between the Emek Valley and Ebla. Which Ebla will eventually become the site of a very fairly large kingdom in the northern Levant and northeastern Mesopotamia. But that's all stuff again for the future. I bring all this up just to kind of show that there are a ton of different forces and factors kind of keeping this region. Not stable, that would be the wrong word, but to kind of keep it balanced to an extent, even though there are so many different peoples spread out through the various river valleys, mountain valleys, hills, plains. But there's definitely back and forth in terms of trade, warfare, though true out-and-out conquest doesn't seem to be something that is too worried about. There are definitely battles, and there are definitely cities that are captured and sacked. But out and out destroyed, very few actually see that happen, at least at the earlier outset of Mesopotamian and written history, with one major exception. And this brings us back to the first city we talked about, Ugarit. Ugarit was completely forgotten. It was completely erased from the historical record for a number of years. In fact, it wasn't discovered, I think, until well, I guess I should say rediscovered, until like the late 20s, early 30s. And it was found by accident. A farmer was just clearing some lands, and he stumbled across one of their necropolises, I think for one of the kings of Ugarit. But yeah, so those are kind of the major sites on the western side of the Syrian coastal mountains. And of course, Adana, which is the primary site of southern Anatolia. Southern Anatolia does have more settlements, and they tend to be larger, but there's not any real city aside from Adana, at least that I saw any record of, that could be traced to this season. Now, that changes very quickly. Once this season ends, you see an explosion of urbanization as the Luwians move in, and the Hurrians too. But there are other peoples in these kind of border regions that we will talk about. The Kizawatna are kind of in between the Hurrians and the Luwians. You have the Ishuwa, who are kind of a little buffer group in the northern Euphrates River Valley. They're kind of stuck in the middle between the Amuru, the Kizawatna, the Proto-Hurrians. There's a whole group of just small tribes that get mentioned, and they are, you'll occasionally see their personal names show up in the records, but they don't necessarily come to the fore in the historical sense, at least not immediately. Some of these peoples, you'll see them kind of briefly mentioned in historical records, and then you jump forward 300 or 400 years and they're big time players due to a number of factors, and we'll talk about all this and more when we get to, of course, that historical period. But yeah, so just keep in mind, yes, you have these small cities being founded. We know in the historical period different things about them than what was probably true when they were initially founded. There's not any one predominant ethnic group in this region. There are still a mix, again, of hunter-gatherers, pastoralists, and early sedentary farmers. Or really not so early in this case. They're kind of old hat. They've been around for at least a millennium or more by the end of this season. I think that's a decent enough place to call it for this week. Kind of got the highlights and the big sites I wanted to talk about. Kind of a mix between larger or slightly larger urban settlements and the smaller villages that are occupying, you know, regions or stretches of river. Kind of showing kind of what the layout is and what it's going to be when we move back into this area next season. As for the next episode, though, we will be crossing the Syrian coastal mountains and getting past the Orontes River that we've talked about in the last couple of episodes, and we'll be moving towards the Euphrates River Valley, and we'll be talking about the Halaf culture, which does have ties to Ugarit, at least at small level ties. How tied in they are, that's something we'll talk about next week. But I hope you're looking forward to that. That'll probably finish up our Levant area, because we're technically moving out of the Levant once we get to the Euphrates, and then we're going to move down the Euphrates and get to Mesopotamia. And that'll probably take 3 or 4 episodes, I would imagine. But yeah. So, again, apologies for the audio quality if it's especially rough. I have stopped and I have listened back. I can kind of hear the fan. I hope it won't be as bad on your end once I kind of try to filter the sound out. But it may still be a little rough. I do, again, apologize for that. I really wish You guys didn't have to deal with that. Almost as much as I wish I didn't have to deal with this heat in my apartment. So I can't wait for fall to be here. Unfortunately, I think I've got about 2-3 more weeks before it shows up where I live. So thank you all for joining me. If you have any questions, comments, feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at war@revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter. You can comment on the YouTube videos that I will post a link to along with the episode description. If you do subscribe to me on YouTube, I do stream live most of the week, sometimes on the weekends too. Random warfare, history games, that kind of thing. And you're welcome to drop in, say hi in the chat, ask questions there. Though you can't send me a link there. YouTube doesn't allow that for some reason. But anyway, thank you all for joining me. I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from wherever or whenever you're listening to this. Thank you all. Have a good night. Peace.